You're listening to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, episode 111. Welcome to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, where we bring you engaging conversations about wildlife and conservation issues from all across the globe. I'm your host, Matt Podolsky. Today's guest on the show is Fitz Cajal. Fitz is a podcaster, filmmaker, and storyteller at Duct Tape Then Beer. He is the producer of The Dirtbag Diaries, one of the most popular podcast series focused on outdoor adventure, and he's also the director of the new film, Paul's Boots. I had a lot of fun talking with Fitz. There aren't too many other people out there that share my same passions for both filmmaking and podcasting. I was particularly interested to hear about Fitz's approach towards producing and directing his film, Paul's Boots. Paul's Boots is about a unique journey across the Appalachian Trail, and anyone who follows this podcast series knows that the Appalachian Trail holds a very special place in my heart. I produced my own film about a trip across the Long Trail in Vermont, the trail that inspired the creation of the Appalachian Trail. Beyond my own fascination with long-distance hiking, however, I'm also excited about this conversation because we are actually screening this film, Paul's Boots, as a part of LaBois Film Festival, the local Boise Film Fest that we co-host with the Land Trust of the Treasure Valley. So our listeners in Boise will actually have the opportunity to see this film up on the big screen at the Egyptian Theater this coming Saturday. Of course, there are additional opportunities to see Paul's Boots and to check out Fitz's work even if you're not a Boise resident. Go check out the show notes page for this information. Today's show notes can be found at wildlensinc.org/EOC111. Now, let's hear from Fitz.
My name is Fitz Cajal, and I'm based out of Seattle, and I kind of do a lot of different things, but really, for the last 20 years, in some shape or form, I've been working on – I use story as a way to communicate my love for the outdoors and my community's love for the outdoors. And that has meant a lot of different things in terms of we've run a pretty successful podcast for the last 10 years called The Dirtbag Diaries. And then I also co-own a business called Duct Tape Then Beer, which does a lot of different things. But it also one of the things that I do for that company is basically make films. I direct films. So for a long time, I've been working in a variety of different formats, whether it's, you know, it used to be print journalism, to working in virtual reality now too. So that's my background. I'm not any one thing. I'm just pretty passionate about the outdoors, the environment, and telling good stories that make people care about this place.
You're probably best known for both the films that you've directed and produced for Duct Tape Then Beer, but also for this long-running podcast series, The Dirtbag Diaries, which has become extremely popular. I guess I'm wondering which came first, right? Did you get into podcasting first or filmmaking, and how did that come about?
Yeah. I'm totally a nerd. I'm just going to lay that. I'm going to put that right out there, and I'm a nerd. And I have always been really – I was fascinated by the internet from a pretty young age, whether it was getting like hooked up at the school library way back in the day when it was pretty boring. And, you know, there'd be a couple things that you could find, but it was clear that this was cool. And basically, I just sort of grew alongside as the internet. And when podcasting came about, I loved it. I loved radio in general. I liked the long form storytelling that you'd find on a radio show like This American Life. I thought it was just a really neat way to tell a story. And once the podcasting kind of started to take off, I just dove right in because I was like, this is perfect. I don't actually need a radio station. I can just go do this on my own. And that's where I started. And the same thing with filmmaking is that I was interested in making films. You know, certainly like there was some video online even early, but it was terrible. People didn't have the speed to run it. There weren't enough people watching it. And I was just patient. And basically, when it seemed like there was enough of an audience and enough that the technology was there, I would just kind of try a new format and a new medium and check it out and do it. So for me, it was I started first with words, then I started with radio, and then eventually evolved into filmmaking and kind of dabble in everything that people care about and use online.
I love the way that you sort of position that of, you know, how you're a storyteller first and you use sort of whichever medium sort of seems to make sense. And I mean, at this point, you're using sort of a diversity of different mediums. But it's also neat to hear you talk about how, like, well, you know, I started podcasting in 2006 because that's when that medium became available to distribute online. Right.
Yeah.
And then you essentially adopt the filmmaking medium at this point when that medium becomes available to distribute online. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Basically what it was. I mean, I didn't have it when I started the filmmaking. I didn't come. I would say the first few things I was very much more in a producer role where I knew the technology and I could make it all happen. I could organize things. I could identify stories. So I came at it much less from like a technical camera side, or if, you know, like I didn't go to film school or anything like that. I came at it from just a passion from like looking at the what people were doing and how people were communicating and sharing stories, and then did it that way. And I still, you know, I'm pretty terrible at holding a camera. Most people do that for me. So yeah. That is definitely like how I went about it.
I'm super interested in both of these endeavors of you because I share that as well. Obviously, I'm, you know, a podcaster and a filmmaker as well. And I just love the emphasis that you place on story and how, I mean, that's something that I tell people over and over again is that story is so much more important than what shot you get, you know, or getting the most beautiful shot in the world. It's how those shots are pieced together to sort of convey the story. And I think that definitely, you know, that focus that you have on the storytelling aspect, I think definitely shows through in your films. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, what it was like to launch a podcast way back in 2006. Not that was really that long ago, but I mean, from a podcasting perspective, I mean, that was like the dawn of this, you know, sort of new era that is, continuing to grow. I guess I'm just wondering, like, what your mindset was back in 2006 when you came up with the idea for the show and launched it. I mean, what ambitions did you have? And you know, what were you trying to achieve with the show?
Yeah, I mean, it was there's a couple answers to that, and it was a very personal process for me because it was I had been working as a freelance writer and was doing okay doing that, and there was this moment at 2006 as the media landscape was really shifting, and basically I had worked more, and then I went and did my taxes, and I realized I made less money. Because everybody was cutting what they were paying for writing in magazines, and they didn't tell you that. They would just send you the check, and your check would have been smaller than what it was last year. And it was really clear that if I was ever going to do anything like be able to buy a house or have a family or have decent healthcare, I couldn't keep doing what I was doing. It just wasn't going to work on that level. And I guess that when I started out, I had some stories left over from my work in freelancing that hadn't sold. And I thought they were pretty good stories. And I figured, hey, I'll just, you know, I've got a little time, you know, maybe I'll go back to school, you know, I'll look for jobs, et cetera, et cetera. But in the meantime, I'm just going to, I really like radio. I really like podcasting, and I'm just going to figure out how to do this. And so I took those stories that I had sort of fallen by the wayside or editors weren't interested in, and I just put them into the radio format. And right away, there was this incredible response to it. It was like I sent it out to 30 friends, and then, you know, I was sort of obsessed with the stats at that stage, and you watched it, and the 30 friends that turned into 300 people listening, and that turned into 3,000 people listening, and it was really incredible. And I realized really quickly in the process that chances are my life had just changed, and that if I played the cards right, that this would be a viable career, that I could do this. And it's not to say that that was like it was a done deal and that it was not without struggles in the last 10 years. Certainly that was not the case, but there was this really clear sort of moment of epiphany where it was like, wow, I just did something that is gonna, you know, like I basically empowered myself and I created my own job if I do this correctly. And it was a really cool experience in terms of like back then, because it is, I mean, it's like weird. It's 10 years ago is not a long time, but in the world, in the history of the internet, 10 years is like, oh my God, that's ancient. Mm-hmm. Imagine what we were doing. I mean, even with podcasting, for like the user, it was quite cumbersome. You had to, first off, you had to know what a podcast was, which was pretty difficult. You had to then subscribe to this thing that you would wait patiently, and then it would download onto your computer, and then you would take it and you'd plug in your iPod, and then you would put it onto your iPod or burn it to a CD, and then you would take it and listen to your car or when you were running. And for the user, it was burdensome. For the creator, it was even more so. I mean, it's like we don't spend any time on the tech side of it, on the back end now. I mean, in terms of like the code side of it, like, but that was really important. And the feed would fail, and like I'd have to like figure out what line of code to replace and change and do all that. And it was, you know, it was kind of terrifying. It was a very touchy thing, and you have to be very careful with it because you could basically explode your entire audience if you weren't, if you touched the wrong thing in the wrong way. And so it definitely, that just, it's so funny to think back about it because I don't worry about that at all anymore. It's all just so, the infrastructure has all been built up around it, and it's quite easy to use. It was an awesome, I mean, you know, as much as that sort of sounds bad, it was an awesome period of time because there was so much, you had to figure it out on your own. And since then it's grown up, and you know, there's a lot of incredible forums where you can, you know, like basically Google a question or something like that, and there's an answer waiting for you. And same was true with filmmaking. You know, it's there's been incredible communities that have built around it. And it was earlier this year I was been working in on a pretty big virtual reality project, and it was the first time in a long time where I Googled something and Google didn't come back with a response. And it had been since the early days of podcasting when I had had that, when I typed in some technical question and there was no answer back, and you're left with the reality that you just got to figure it out. And that was a really cool moment in my life and in my career. And I really appreciate it, even though at the time I think it probably made me want to tear my hair out. But that period, it's just like, you don't get that many, there's not that many times in where you get to not be shown the way, but you get to figure out what the way is for your own, you know, for not just you, but for an entire community. And that was really cool. And I don't mean to say like I figured it out on my own. I mean, like, there were many of us that were doing it simultaneously, and then that developed into the bigger community. But there was this sort of feeling of autonomy, which was really cool and left a big impression on me for the long term.
We launched our podcast about 2 years ago, and I'm absolutely blown away by how much easier it is to put out and release a podcast series now than it was just 2 years ago. I mean, a lot has happened just in the last few years, as far as the ease of launching your own show and becoming a podcaster, right?
And I don't even know. It's funny. I don't even know what those changes are. It's like I've just been going through it for so long and doing it all. And it's like I'm kind of just like, oh yeah, we just keep doing our same old thing. But I just notice there's less problems with it now.
Right.
It's funny.
Yeah, the show has become, you know, this really popular podcast series, and one of the longest running podcast series about, you know, this topic of like sort of outdoor adventure, and there's definitely a lot of connections with like conservation and the environment in there. What's next? I mean, what plans do you have for the Dirtbag Diaries moving forward? Anything specific you want to talk about?
You know, I mean, I think that for us, it's just a matter of figuring out how to expand. There's no grand vision for this thing. I think that at some point early on, I thought it'd be pretty cool if we could make this last for 10 years. And I didn't really think that was probably going to happen. And to have it made it there feels like a little bit of a landmark. But that's not some high lofty goal. That's just like, I wonder if I could do that for 10 years. And I think that there's no grand crazy vision for it. It is what it is, and it's this wonderful thing, and it's got a wonderful community around it. And I think my biggest hope for it is that we can continue to expand our community, to continue to expand the number of voices that are involved in the show and expand the number of perspectives, because that's the same thing that's happened to the outdoor community, is that it's a you know, on one hand, it's become even more specialized. Like there's more hardcore niches than there were 10 years ago. And at the same point, it's become much more diverse. And I think we're entering into a new era as a community where there's a lot of different perspectives versus just, you know, the ones that come out of the ski towns or out of Boulder or, you know, wherever. I think that our community has grown, and I hope that the show continues to grow alongside of our community, and also helps the community grow in the right ways. So I think that that's kind of where I look at it.
It's interesting you say that, because I mean, there's a lot of crossover sort of between what you just said and a lot of the discussions that we've been having about the podcast series that we produce, Eyes on Conservation. You know, sort of talking about, you know, the importance of diversity and bringing new and different groups sort of into the fold, and also just showing people what the word conservation means. And you know, I think that sort of goes for like the outdoors as well. Is like, there's a lot of people that they hear those terms and they think of it as like sort of they put that into a box and don't realize that it's interconnected with literally everything in their lives, you know.
Yeah. So it means many connections. Different things to many different people. And I think that's like, it's something that we need to be aware of. I mean, I think everybody in the sort of outdoor space kind of needs to be aware of that. I mean, it's like, I mean, make the things you love to make. I don't mean to tell another creative what they should be doing. But I think it is really important to think that it's like that there's a space for a lot of different voices and a lot of different perspectives when it comes to the outdoors and what it means to do it. You know, it's not everybody needs to wear a helmet. If that makes, you know, it's like not everybody needs to do something where it's like a helmet is required. There's a lot of ways to appreciate it. And I think that there's a lot of ways to powerfully connect with the natural world. And I do, you know, if you bring up the topic of conversation, I do feel like part of the way that we are going to continue to make smart decisions with this planet and with our footprint on this planet, because we're going to have to do that, is we're going to need people that care about it. And I think that it really helps if you have a personal relationship with the natural world. I just think it's like you're way more likely to care about something if you have connection with it. And I think that's true for not just like people, not just like typical sort of kayakers or long distance hikers or rock climbers, but it's true for the people that hunt and fish. And it's like there's a lot of ways to bridge the various sides of our communities to become, you know, a powerful force that helps our leaders make good decisions about how we use our lands.
It's interesting that you brought up hunting and fishing, because that was actually on my mind as well as you were talking about, you know, reaching out and sort of broadening the scope of what people think about when they talk about like a connection with the natural world, right? Because that's a group of people that for a long time they've sort of been put in their own box, right? Like those types of activities that people do in the outdoors and that lead to a lot of the same types of connections with the natural world are sort of separate in a certain way, and or at least in a lot of people's minds. But I mean, one of the things that I think we've seen just in the last few months actually is hunting groups coming together with conservation groups. And I mean, that's something that I'm starting to see that is really hopeful to me. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's something that, like, you guys have contemplated covering, like, you know, sort of this growing movement to sort of bring these two communities together.
Oddly enough, with our work at Duct Tape and Beer, which is the company that owns the diaries and that basically I work for, we did a lot of work on those issues to help bring those communities together. That was kind of, that's been one of our big projects in the last few years, is how to create a message about public lands, and particularly the fact that there's been this incredible push to sell off public lands or to turn federal lands over to the states. That was one of the big things we've been working on the last year and a half, was a lot of the messaging around that, so that we could build that a diverse set of communities in the outdoors could come together and kind of rally to stop some of these really bad ideas that keep cropping up in state legislatures and at the federal level.
That is an issue that is at the forefront of a lot of people's minds right now. I just did a panel discussion of a whole bunch of filmmakers, a whole bunch of Boise-based filmmakers that are screening films of theirs at this film festival, Le Bois Film Festival, that we're co-hosting in a couple of weeks. And that topic is at the forefront of a lot of people's minds. That's something that came up, sort of a common theme throughout a lot of the films that we're screening. but clearly something that a lot of filmmakers and you know, specifically filmmakers that you know are working in this space of, you know, telling stories about the outdoors and conservation and wildlife definitely are concerned about. So it's neat to hear that you've been working, you know, and your company has been working specifically to bring those two groups together, because I think that's a really, really important aspect of that topic. So I want to kind of shift focus here and talk a little bit about filmmaking, the filmmaking side of what you do. I mentioned this film festival, Le Bois Film Festival, that we're co-hosting. So one of your most recent films, Paul's Boots, is going to be screening at this event, Le Bois Film Festival. So I'm super excited about screening this film, in part because I'm a long distance hiker myself, and I've never through hiked the entire Appalachian Trail, but I've done sections of it, and I've hiked the Long Trail in Vermont, and so it's a topic that is close to my heart, and I think I've probably watched just about every documentary about through hiking the Appalachian Trail that's out there. And your film, Paul's Boots, stood out. And so I kind of want to just talk a little bit about, you know, how this project got started, you know, what the inspiration was that led to the creation of this film.
I mean, basically what happened is, you know, we were all sitting around and we got an email through the Dirtbag Diaries account, and Jen, who's a producer at the show, kind of came over and was like, I got something you should read. And this woman, Malin, had reached out from Australia to tell us about her husband. And we get a lot of people writing in to sort of share moments from their lives and, you know, talk about this. And this letter, you could tell there was an intensity to it. And she told us about Paul. And Paul was, you know, basically a guy who really liked to help other people. He loved the outdoors. He always loved the outdoors kind of growing up. And life just kind of got in the way. You know, his mom got sick. You know, he spent 5 years kind of caring for her, and then his dad got sick. Along the way, his health deteriorated. He had a couple heart attacks, and really he got to this point where it was pretty difficult to just get outside and do that. It was hard to walk. His heart wasn't working that well. And he, in the last year of his life, basically planned on going to hike the AT, you know, the entire Appalachian Trail, even though, you know, realistically that wasn't an option with his condition and where he was at. And, you know, he passed away about a year and a half ago. When Malin, his wife, went to go clean out his stuff, she just couldn't bear to like throw away his boots. You know, there were these like polished hiking boots ready to go out on the Appalachian Trail. And so she reached out to us and just asked if we knew somebody who might be able to carry them for like a 2-week trip. you know, to just do a short section and send her some photos, and that would just make her, that would make her day. And we thought about it, and we're like, you know, I made a couple calls to friends who had hiked the AT, and we thought about it, and we thought, you know what, I bet you these boots will make it the entire length. I bet you this entire community will come together and people will shoulder the load and take these boots across the entire Appalachian Trail. And that was sort of our hypothesis, and we got out and we basically put out a call to action into that community. And you know, I think we had almost 500 people reach out to us and offer their time, their services to put those boots on their back and hike with them. And you know, there weren't enough days in the summer to have all those people carry those boots, but basically I think we ended up having about 25 groups carry them. Sometimes it'd be an individual, sometimes it'd be like a couple buddies would go out and do it together. But they made from late March to the end of August, they ended up going all the way from Georgia to Katahdin. And then some too. There's some overlap. I think they actually hiked more than the 2,190 miles. So it was a pretty incredible, you know, that was how that project got started. It was just this belief in this community that, you know, something kind of almost silly sounding that you would hike with a pair of 5-pound heavy leather boots strapped to your backpack because they're weight. I mean, Paul was a big guy, so he had size 13 feet, and there's no way, you know, I mean, one person wore them for a little bit and like got horrible blisters within like 20 minutes. You know, there's just, it was like you had to carry these things that were just impeding your progress because every pound does count when you do that long distance hiking. And yet, people gladly did it, and they had incredible experiences. It connected them with other hikers because so many of the people that were hiking the trail knew about the boots story before they ever saw them. And it was one of the coolest projects I've ever been involved in. I had no idea what would happen when we started, which is not typical of our projects. It's like that turns out is actually a really bad way to make a film, is to have no idea how it's all going to happen. But we just figured we figured it through and just did our best and kind of left it up to the community, and we ended up with something I'm very proud of, you know, very, very proud to have been a part of. Seeing those boots reach the end of the trail, and Malin, Paul's wife, came out for that final bit, she flew over from Australia and joined us for a week. And Paul's brother came out and actually carried boots to the top of Katahdin. Those were some of the coolest moments that I've ever been involved in, and it felt the entire time it felt like you were more than just yourself, and that's a cool feeling to be involved in as a filmmaker.
It's a unique way to introduce viewers to a diversity of characters and to introduce them to this community, right? By basically showing them, like, you know, it sort of reveals something about the character of the community itself that, you know, it's so selfless that they would just volunteer to carry these boots, which, you know, and like you said, I mean, that to someone who doesn't have experience, you know, long distance hiking, like that might seem like not too big of a deal. But like when you're a long distance backpacker, I mean, you spend so much time, like, you know, reducing the weight of your pack. And like it's literally the most important aspect of planning a trip like that. And
totally. I mean, like, because like that weights two to three days worth of food. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the difference of I mean, that kind of puts it in as like that's about the same weight as what you need to eat for 3 days. Yeah. And you're like just loading that on your back on top of that, and that's, man, it was cool to see. Mm-hmm. how that community came together.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a very creative way to sort of reveal and sort of the nature of that community in a way that I hadn't seen in any of the other docs out there about through hiking the Appalachian Trail. And certainly a lot of other people have tried, you know, to sort of show what that community is really like and introduce people to a diversity of characters. But you hit on sort of a strategy to do that that really resonated with me. And you know, based on the reactions you've been getting from the film, it certainly resonates with other people as well. So I'm curious to learn a little bit about the logistics of shooting this film, because
you know
you're shooting in often these remote locations, you know, along stretches of the Appalachian Trail, which, you know, goes over 2,000 miles. I guess I'm wondering, like how you guys sort of approach that, and how you sort of figured out, like, you know, what would be the most important moments to shoot, and I mean, were you or members of your crew sort of traveling out to, like, certain spots to, like, shoot some segments of that yourselves? And I imagine you were also sort of recruiting volunteers to, like, shoot footage to contribute to the project as well.
It was that was the biggest hurdle. We had to come up with a way to pull this off, and I'm not really in a position where I could be like, hey family, I'm leaving you and I'm gonna go with the AT for the next 6 months. that was not the way to do that. And in truth, it just was like, we needed kind of more flexibility. We needed to be able to kind of, like, work with the people that had volunteered. So it wasn't always like a super linear path up the, I mean, they went the length of the trail, but it was a trick to figure out how to do it. And our biggest hurdles, I'm a big believer in that. I think that if you can, you know, you can help people figure out how to tell their own story. And that's something that I think runs through a lot of my work, is that I think that I try to reach out and I try to allow people to take control of their own story and tell it. And so what we did is we just shipped people a camera. When they got the boots, there'd be a camera in it and, you know, a couple of different batteries, and we would sort of show them some, we'd, you know, have a little note about what examples, what they should be shooting, what they should be telling us about. And then what we'd do is we'd go out as a crew. There are probably four of us that went out and did time on the trail. We would kind of catch up with people in strategic locations at those moments where we thought would be important. Or I'd even, like, you know, we'd go out and just interview somebody after they'd taken the trip, so we could get their perspective on it. They wouldn't be on the trail, but we would just go into their home and, you know, interview them and get the audio that needed to go along with the footage that they'd captured on that trip. And so there'd be certain, I mean, certainly we did good sections of the trail, but we didn't just, like, be there for every single day. We tried to empower the people that were carrots to tell their own story and then just did our best to help them do that, and then would sort of strategically add to it through interviews and a little bit of, you know, maybe coming out and hiking with them for a day or two.
It's super interesting. You know, for me as a fellow filmmaker, like, the logistics of that are super fascinating to me. And actually something I've contemplated as well, of sort of like, if you were to tell a story about an adventure on a long distance hiking trip like that, like, how would you approach it? And I love the fact that you sort of empowered your characters to tell their own story and to shoot their own footage. That it definitely adds a unique element. It adds character to the film, I think, for sure.
And a lot of that stuff is, like, I just couldn't even have dreamed it up. I mean, some of the stuff that people would share or do, or their sense of humors, it all just came across. And I couldn't, you know, I mean, I just couldn't have, they did a better job than I could have done, and that was really cool to turn it over, and I'm so thankful for everybody who did it, because it's not just they didn't just do the, you know, have this extra burden of carrying the boots, but they've kind of went for it with sharing their own stories, and I think it came through in that piece.
So I guess I wonder, you know, what kind of reactions you've gotten to the film. You know, it's been out, you've released it, you've screened it at a bunch of film festivals and a lot of other venues. I mean, you know, what kind of responses have you gotten? And I mean, I guess specifically, I'm curious, like, have you set up screenings that are, like, specifically geared towards, like, the trail community that you're portraying in the film?
You know, that's an interesting question. I feel sort of bad, but I kind of, I finished that piece and we worked so hard on it that I sort of checked out a little bit, and I just went right into the next big project, basically, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't totally aware of it. I had such a powerful experience making it and getting to know some of the people in the film that I didn't pay much attention to at all, and it has been, I mean, I think people like it. I mean, I think that there's, you know, on the online version of it, I think there's more than a million views on it. So I think that must mean that people were sharing it and cared about it and wanted to spread it, because, you know, that's pretty cool. You know, in terms of reaching out, we've had a lot of people reach out and wanting to show it, and we always help them do that. But we haven't been organizing quite as many events as we might have. It's so time. I mean, you know, from putting on this film festival, it's such a time intensive process to do it. I mean, every time you make an event, it's like hundreds of hours of time. So, you know, we definitely will respond if people want to show it. We're like really excited when people want to do that, and we'll reach out to them. But it's funny. I've stayed more. I think I ended up just, it was such a personal process for me to be involved in. I think I ended up staying in touch with more of the hikers themselves in it, and really cared about their responses. And it wasn't that I didn't care about what the community had to say. I think it just that's kind of where my heart lay after the whole process.
Yeah, fair enough. And I mean, I can definitely relate to needing to take a break after investing so much time and energy into a specific project. One of the things that you know, I was interesting to me, because this is something that we've been experimenting as well with our filmmaking and our podcasting, is the fact that your podcast series, The Dirtbag Diaries, I mean, sort of play this role, like, while you were producing the film, of like sort of sharing updates and you know, you did sort of podcast stories focused on this story you were telling that would become Paul's Boots, the film, over the course of the project, which I thought was an interesting approach. I mean, did that just seem like a natural sort of approach to you, since the podcast is such a big part of what you guys do?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because we'd waited. I mean, when we started this process, it was like, it really felt like choose your own adventure filmmaking. it was a little bit, you know, didn't always know what strategy to take. And I think that originally we'd sort of envisioned that we might be able to like do a few, you know, sort of short vignettes along the way as the boots were there, and that we would do that just with like short little, you know, web videos. And the truth is, we just didn't have time. You know, it was all moving so quickly, and we were tasked with such a big project of coordinating where these boots would be and with all these hikers, and that we didn't really have time. The diaries made sense to do it just because it was an easier format to do it in, and we had kind of more resources in our office to use that as the way. And I for me, I thought it was really cool because it did. I think it also, you know, the other thing we did is we had a pretty robust like social media gathering around it. So there'd be, through Instagram and Facebook, the hikers would share all these photos as they were carrying. You know, I mean, a lot of these people would post, you know, four or five images from a week long trip or even more than that. And so there became a very much an unfolding story under, you know, a hashtag Paul Walks On. And so that was really neat. It wasn't just the diaries, but people were able to sort of follow along, almost not in real time, but pretty close to it. I think that was the other, you know, interesting thing is I'd hiked some of the AT when I was younger, and it's wild because there's basically cell coverage on it the entire way. So you would be, you know, like I'd be texting with a hiker, you know, while they were carrying the boots, and you know, they'd be like, "Oh, I wrote this thing. Is it cool if I post it?" And be like, "Yeah, absolutely." So there was an incredible reality is that it wasn't just the podcast that was giving updates along the way, but it was for the people that were interested. They followed along pretty intensely on social media, and it was cool. It was neat too, because a lot of the hikers that carried it became friends through that shared experience.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's really fascinating, and that's something I hadn't really thought about too much. But similarly to you, you know, I spent some time hiking a few sections of the Appalachian Trail 10 plus years ago, right? And of course, yeah, nobody brought cell phones along with them on the trail. There's no reason to to have that. And it sort of creates this interesting the method of communication on the trail is super fascinating. And I'm sure that certain aspects of this maintain, but obviously, like, the fact that you have cell coverage and a lot of people are carrying cell phones and you can text your friends, you know, who are ahead or behind you on the trail, certainly changes things. But that was one of the most striking things for me that I got out of the time I spent on the trail years ago, is that you can communicate with the people behind you by leaving messages in all of these notebooks that are found in essentially every single shelter has a little message book. And you know, that's sort of a part of the culture, is that when you pass through, you leave a little note. And the people behind you can read those notes and learn about your trip, right? But the people that are ahead of you, you just never have communication with them. Like, there's no way, if someone passes you and then you never catch up, you're never going to see them again. You're never going to hear from them again. But the people behind you may have never met you before, but they're following your story. And then, you know, if they eventually catch up with you, then all of a sudden there's like this recognition of like, oh my God, I've been following your story for months and I finally caught up with you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's all changed. I mean, it's the way people, are using the, you know, various forms of connectivity with the phones. That's all changing. I mean, I think I think there's some people that really lament the death of the sort of no cell phones in the woods, and they, you know, I think the truth is that it's not your grandfather's trail anymore. You know, it's changed and evolved, and it was really neat to see. Personally, I wouldn't want to spend all my, if I had that time off, I would probably be like, cool, I'm just tucking away the cell phone and I'm checking out. That's just, you know, how my personal preference for dealing with spending time in the woods is I like to kind of be removed from my phone and whatnot. But for the hikers, it was really cool. I mean, you'd see them and they would all know, and they'd know even the southbound, northbounders, like they would be like, well, there's this one guy who's headed south. And I mean, they would know all of it before it was coming. And I think it's pretty different. I've never seen, you know, out west, it's like you go into the mountains and you lose cell coverage, you know, you hike a trail. It's like, it's not really an option. I mean, every once in a while you'll get a couple of bars here and there, but it's not really like that. And back east, it's just, it's ubiquitous, and it was interesting to see how that empowered, you know, that tool had been used inside the community.
Yeah, for sure. It's super fascinating. And I mean, yeah, that's another interesting point about the difference between out west and back east, right? Is that, you know, yeah, it's still kind of like that out here. I mean, you go out into the wilderness and it's pretty much guaranteed that you're not going to have cell coverage. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's like another thing that I guess, you know, sets the Appalachian Trail apart from really other long distance trails out there, is that, you know, it's like you're kind of in the woods and kind of out in this remote area by a certain definition, right? But you're never too far from civilization and areas, you know, with large densities of human population.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing the film to Boise and sharing the story. It's thanks for doing what you do and building community inside of, you know, inside of Boise. It's cool. It's neat to see people do it both in digital ways and in the fashion analog, where you put a butt in a movie seat. That's cool that you're doing that. So I just want to say thanks.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, we're super excited to have the opportunity to screen Paul's Boots. And yeah, you're right. I mean, like you guys, a huge amount of what we do is just sort of goes out into this digital realm, you know, but it is important every once in a while to, yeah, get people's butts in seats and have that shared experience. You know, the reactions that you get to a film with 700 or 800 people sitting in the audience are different and interesting and often unexpected. So
I love that. I mean, as for someone who's done a lot of online work, I love that feeling. I love being in that room and seeing where people laugh or where the crowd will go silent. And it's such a cool experience.
Super fun for a filmmaker. And I mean, there like I said, there are always surprises. Like the and audience never responds exactly how you expect they will to something that you've produced. It's been my experience, at least. So it'll be fun. I'll send you a report after the Paul's Boot screening, cool. And if anything, if there's any really interesting responses, I'll let you know.
Okay, thanks, Matt.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Fitz, for joining us for this episode of the podcast, and for sharing all these amazing experiences that you've had, you know, on your own sort of podcasting and filmmaking adventures.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
All right, that was our conversation with Fitz Cahal from Duct Tape Then Beer. I love Fitz's perspective on storytelling and how he has adopted new mediums for conveying these stories as technology has made new forms of communication more accessible. It was also super interesting to hear about how technology has changed the experiences of thru-hikers on the Appalachian Trail. These changes have had a pretty dramatic effect on the trail community, and we see this in Fitz's film, Paul's Boots. So as I mentioned before the interview, we are screening Paul's Boots as a part of Le Bois Film Festival, the local Boise Film Fest that we co-host with the Land Trust of the Treasure Valley. If you want to learn more about the film or the festival, you can head on over to the show notes page for this episode, which you'll find at wildlensinc.org/EOC111. That's wildlensinc.org/EOC111. If you enjoyed today's conversation, you can subscribe to the Eyes on Conservation podcast via iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or just about any other podcatcher you can think of. If you really feel like helping us out today, you can leave us an honest rating and review on iTunes. All you have to do is search for Eyes on Conservation in the iTunes store or follow the link on the show notes page. The Eyes on Conservation podcast is a production of Wild Lens. Today's episode was produced by myself, your host, Matt Podolsky. Our theme music is by The Humidors.